welcome back to another episode of Barely Legal in Web3. Today we're talking about VCs in Singapore and around the world. I'm here with Chin En Lui, who is with Sizon Capital. Chin En, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Jamilia. Really excited.
I'm excited to really get into what's going on in the space, because I know so many people are interested in really understanding, number one, how to approach VCs, number two, what the trends are, what you're seeing on your end. So we have a lot to discuss.
Yeah, that's so much to unpack, especially given the current market conditions, right? Everyone is excited. Feels like the heat is back. So
the heat is back.
Looking forward. Yeah, it is.
Can you tell us a bit about what you do and what Sizon Capital does?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm fortunate to kind of have the opportunity to lead Sizon Capital. We are quite uniquely positioned. So like many VCs out there, we invest in early stage projects in both Web2, Web3, and sort of the in-between. But what's unique is that we are actually a corporate venture capital fund, which means we only have one single limited partner, one single shareholder. And because of that, there's actually a lot of flexibility and a lot of things that we can do that perhaps other VC funds might not be able to, right? So a bit of context, the parent company is one of the largest credit card companies in Japan, a large traditional finance institution. And the moment you say that to people often, Japanese, traditional finance, publicly listed, certain images start to form in your head, right? And to be honest, that was me when I first heard about this company, this role. But as it turns out, the common conception of slow, boring, traditional couldn't be further away from the truth, which is why I'm so excited to be here, because what we really get a chance to do is to be a speedboat to the aircraft carrier, right? So we are really kind of out there, putting ourselves out there, posting memes on LinkedIn, engaging in the shitcoin talk on Twitter. But I think really just understanding how Web3 culture works, investing in it, supporting founders, yet we still have the strength and the resources of a large financial institution.
So there is a strategy behind your memes on LinkedIn. I've always wondered about that.
Now, I want to talk a bit about that because also the topic today, it's about VCs, right?
Yeah.
So a bit of background, I previously started a recruitment tech company that today is one of the larger recruitment tech companies in the region. It's a Series D company called Glints. And I went through the whole process of raising venture myself, right? As a 20-year-old founder with no experience, you know, no formal work experience, right? Fresh out of high school, not even college, right? Going through the process of raising from VCs and all of that 10 years ago was just such a formative experience, right? And having gone through that, I think I realized that often the role VCs play, it's just really providing capital. That's the number one value add. And founders are the heroes of the story. But I think somewhere along the way, as this ecosystem has, you know, developed, often VCs like to shine the spotlight on themselves, right? They often like to claim credit for success of the company more than actually what they are. So I thought, you know, sometimes we take ourselves too seriously. Sometimes LinkedIn can feel like just a place to humble brag, or not so humble, just brag, right? So let's lighten it up. Let's have some fun. So, yeah.
I love that. And certainly all the posts that you share are really entertaining and they do make me laugh.
Thank you.
You know, you talked a little bit about, you know, this journey that you were on personally. Yep. And, you know, when I think of myself, even in, you know, this stage with all the corporate experience I have and going for funding, it does seem intimidating. But for you, somebody who was 20 at the time and had no corporate experience, can you tell us a bit about that? Because I'm sure you had some funny moments in there.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So I think it's really kind of, there was just no idea on how to get started. In fact, how we actually got into this whole startup was an angel investor who we met for the first time said, hey, do you want some money to turn this into a company? And like, once again, it's kind of a series of serendipitous events of how that happened. And one thing led to another. And first the angel investor came in. We went to the angel investor. We said, hey, we need 50K. We had no idea where the number came from. 50K just sounded like a pretty big number at that point where you're 20 years old, more money than we've ever seen in our life. And the angel investor said, yes. And then we were like, okay, then how do you incorporate a company? Right? Like, so you can imagine, right? That was how green we were. But I think people were just willing to take a bet on us. And I think to this day, I'm very grateful to those investors, both the angels and the VCs for that. But I think what we really had going at that point was a story, right? And I think every good fundraise, every good startup, every good founding journey starts with a story, right? And I think for us, the story was pretty compelling at that point, which was three kind of Ivy League or, you know, top tier university bound students, Asian students, on full ride government scholarships, giving up all of that to build a company, right? And I think that was the story that kind of really helped us to raise not just the first round, but I would say the first, second, and maybe even the third round, right? Then, of course, when it came to the third round, like the CVC, then the business had to do the talking in terms of the results and all of that. But I think for all the founders that kind of, sorry, all the investors that came in for the first and second round, it was purely just based on story and narrative.
Wow. As a mother, when I hear that, okay, the mom hat comes on and I'm like, grab the sandal. Like, what? What did you face? I mean, was everybody telling you, don't do that?
My parents were really upset, but I'm still grateful that they supported me really, and especially like financially, to break that scholarship bond because it was expensive, right? But yeah, so for context, my dad is a university professor. My mom's a middle school Chinese teacher. So both in academia, both had little or zero experience in sort of like the world of business. And so to them, I was on this path of perfection, right? As a typical Asian student, getting your A's, getting to a top tier university, getting a government scholarship, it was like textbook success of what they would imagine. But here I was veering off to another path, building my own company. And of course, they had very strong objections. And even after supporting me financially, which is what I'm grateful for, it was still very hard for them to accept, right? But I think at the end of the day, it came down to which path would I regret not taking, right? And I think looking back, I definitely made the right decision because it's like, you know, the amount of learning, the amount of growth I had was phenomenal. And really through that journey, I saw what good investors and not so good investors were like, right? I think we really had the opportunity to work with many investors. By the time we were at Series A, we had to use MailChimp to send out investor updates because it was that large our investor pool. But that really kind of guided me and also made me have the resolve, right? That if one day I ever were to sit across the other table, which today I am, what kind of investor I want to become? Yeah.
Wow, there's so many points I could touch on in that. And I think what resonates with me the most personally is this idea that you had this kind of identity that was instilled in you. Yeah. I mean, they're both in education, academia, and then you have the cultural part too that we're not even talking about, what it means for parents in Singapore for their child to get into really good school, full ride, and to just say, this is not for me.
Yes.
And how strong you had to be in knowing who you are to kind of identify that at 20. that's huge. And I think for many people who want to get into this space full time, they're also faced with that. I mean, at some point you have to look in the mirror and just say like, look, we're going to do it.
And I think really, you know, committing to that decision was really what changed the trajectory of the company. I think in the first maybe 18 months of starting the startup, me and my two other co-founders were still, I guess that was the backup option, right? If things don't work out, we don't fundraise, we'll go to school, full ride scholarship. Not a bad backup option by all means and all measures.
Acceptable.
Yeah, acceptable. Barely, right? No, but I think like really when the three of us gave up, right? And when, like especially for me, there was that financial kind of burden that I had to pay off, right? And I promised my parents I would pay them back every single cent because this is my decision, right? And so basically I was sort of in debt, right? Theoretically below bankrupt, because bankrupt you have zero, but I was basically negative, right? That's on the net wealth number at a point. Like it really just shifts a different mindset. It's like, you got to make this work, right? We're going to go all out. And I think that level of intensity and that commitment, I think that really helped change the trajectory of the company and even also for my growth journey.
So I know you've gone through a lot more than you're even able to kind of, you know, share on this in this very short segment. But this journey that you've gone through, do you, now that you're on the other side of the table, look for some parts of that in founders when you're talking to them?
Yeah, definitely. I think the biggest thing I look up for is really, I think, resilience, right? When the markets are where it is today, it's easy to come out to say, I want to build a company, I want to raise X million dollars, I want to do something. But I think really the question I ask myself, it's, you know, when times get tough, and inevitably they will, right? We just came from a period where it was extremely tough for the whole industry. Will they still be around? Are these fair weather founders, or really will they really hunker down and, you know, try to make things work, right? Because honestly, that's also something I've seen kind of having joined this industry, having joined Web3, having joined VC, right at the peak of the bull in 2021, right? There's founders out there who get excited when markets are hot, they raise a bunch of funding, and when things don't go well, they're like, oops, sorry guys, that's it, right? Like, sorry, doesn't work, right? And so I think that really kind of is frustrating, right? Of course, from a financial lens as an investor, but also more just as an individual, and how I've been through the journey and how the struggle is real. Because when you're a founder, it's not just your obligation to investors. In fact, I think investors is like the third, right? I think it's really your obligation to your employees even, because these are their livelihoods, right? Their families, their obligations. So I think there's a lot of this that comes into consideration in terms of the character of the founders. Of course, it takes time to really understand, get to know that, reference checks come in useful. Which is why I think we have been also continuously investing during the bear market, because we actually get the time to build relationships with founders and get to know them. And I think that's a lot better, right? When I first joined the bull market, rounds were getting closed the next day, right? It's like today, first meeting, tomorrow you tell me whether you're in or not. It's okay if you're not in because our round will be full, right?
Wow.
And so when you're faced in such situations like that, of course, sometimes you just have to make a leap of faith. But I think really it's sometimes really hard to judge a founder's character, but over time, as you build a relationship, it really shows.
Looking back on some founders that you've, or I mean, just your entire experience, what would you say are sort of three red flags that go off in your mind as you're having a conversation with the founder? You're like, okay, this is not going to work.
Yeah. So the first one I'm going to say, it's, you know, there's all those traits and qualities that I feel like it's a bit more cliche, but I'll just jump right to something that is a bit more controversial. I feel like those who don't think enough about go-to-market, or founders who basically don't want to do sales, that's to me a red flag, right? Look, it's okay if it's a co-founder team, one person is a CTO, one person is, but at least one person on the founding team must be comfortable putting himself or herself out there and selling, right? If someone comes to me and tell me that they want to build the next Slack, the next Notion, the next product-led growth thing, I did tend to get very skeptical, right? Because I think there really is a lot of merit in learning how to sell, and not necessarily sell in terms of like pick up cold call or all that, right? But it's just the ability to have a well thought through go to market, figure out what distribution channels look like, think about how do you scale a BD, a sales team. I think those are underrated things. And when I look back on, you know, sort of the investments that I do or I didn't do, usually there's a very strong correlation between how well they perform and how go-to-market oriented they are versus how product obsessed they is. And don't get me wrong, of course, it's important to have a good enough product, right? But a lot of times, if you just obsess about product, to build it and it will come, it just doesn't seem to work, right? And honestly, there's also so many products out there that just by being first to the door, that's all that matters, right? Like, you don't need a perfect product, but you just need to be first to the door, and then people just get used to it, right? I mean, look at Salesforce, right? Literally every salesperson out there probably hates Salesforce, but the reason is they have an excellent, amazing go-to-market, right? They sell into the C-suite, right? Mm-hmm. They are the company they are today, but then it's like, yeah, so I think the point is that there are just so many other alternatives out there, but why is something that perhaps the UI, UX is far from ideal? Why is it still like the market leader in CRM today? To me, it's just basically a sign that they are go-to-market led. And so I think that to me is one of the biggest kind of things that actually I look out for.
I think that's so, you know, kind of like on point, because you could have the best product in the world.
Correct.
But if you're not pushing it, if nobody sees it, if it's just like on a dusty shelf somewhere in the closet.
Correct.
So the value is not there. The value is in the transaction.
Correct.
And I think for many professionals that are sort of transitioning over to this entrepreneurial, they have to get off of their ego horse and 100%. Really just like send the email, man. You
Correct.
Know, send out the newsletter, ask
Correct.
For the sale.
Correct.
Ask for people to sign up.
Yes.
I'm talking to myself. ask for the thing because that's really where the value is.
100%. And I think, you know, and also I also think a sub point to that is that at the early days, the founder has to be the one to do the sales, right? You can't just hire someone to do it, because if you yourself don't even understand, can't even convince someone, what hope does whatever employees that you have over there have, right? And I think exactly you're spot on about getting off the ego. because that was the lesson I personally learned, right? 20, 21 years old, having raised venture funding, got into TechCrunch. I was pretty inflated, my ego, right, at that point, right? And then when I came back, I was like, you know, I dropped out of Stanford. I gave up my Fulbright scholarship. We just raced around. I'm not going to do sales, right? We're going to do the product. We're going to build a great product. That was me almost 10 years ago. And then it was really one of our investors who really became more like a coach, right? Who really sat us down and he said, pick up the phone, make 10 calls. At the end of today, report to me how many calls you made, what is the conversion rate. And I refused to do it because I was like, why? I didn't drop out of Stanford to be a cold caller. Yeah, but then he was just like, he checked in at the end of the day, why didn't you do it? Do it tomorrow. And so I picked up the phone and I can tell you the feeling was real, right? The fear of rejection. Mm-hmm. So many times I was like, please don't pick up, please don't pick up, please don't pick up, right? And it's, oh, they didn't pick up. Okay, yep, this person didn't pick up. Done, right? But then once I got past that, then, that's when we started to build out a sales script, a sales process, right? And then once that is done, it's easy to scale because I have done it myself. These are my numbers. Every 10 calls I make, I'll have 2 meetings. Every 2 meetings I get, it will get 1 sale. And so if I can say that with confidence, then I am in a good position to lead my team, right? Because it's like, you guys have no excuse. I have tried this myself. It works. Follow it, right? And I think that's really kind of the spirit of, really, that's why I feel like it was a journey for me to get there. And really, the largest part was not about the skills, right? Everyone can call. Everyone can say a script. It's really about the ego, right? Put it aside. Just go out there and sell.
Yeah. The ego issue is huge. And then I think there's so much learning in that conversation with the customer to really understand why. Like, where's the friction?
Correct.
Like, what is it about that what I'm selling that you think is not a fit? Or is it too expensive? Or is it the way I'm presenting it?
Correct.
And then you take it back and you fix it.
Exactly.
And we've done that with ByteVal, even with the consulting side and the services.
Yep.
What are the problems people are having? Try to make it work, make it fit into the persona's budget and make it, something that's digestible.
Correct.
Okay. So we've got the sales piece as the first red flag. What's the second red flag?
No, I think the second red flag I have, it's really kind of like, as I think about what these founders want in terms of, I would say, the midterm, right? I think individual goals and ambitions become pretty important. And I think, for lack of a better words to put it, I think for those who want to see this as path to riches and purely that, I think that comes out as another red flag, right? Mm-hmm. And that's because really, statistically speaking, by the way, it's also not a great way to get rich. Unfortunately, you don't build a company to get rich, right? I feel like you build a company because you have a purpose and there's no other way, or you see something that no one else is doing and you just feel like you are the right person to do it. I think really basically becoming mission-driven versus mercenary-driven, I think that becomes something that's really important in the early days, because I think really as the tough gets going, right? There's going to be a lot of missteps, a lot of failures, and a lot. It really kind of shows. And once if people are just oriented towards, I want to make money, I think very quickly, they will also come to the same conclusion that it's not a great way to make money. And then they will quit, right? They will give up, right? And of course, as investors, we don't want that, right? So I think really finding people who are just mission-driven, and almost the flip side of that, it's almost like they're cockroaches, right? It's like you can kill them, right? They'll just always figure out what needs to be done, how to get there, how to move on. And I think that's really just something it's a red flag versus a green flag, I guess, in terms of mission-driven.
I think it's a great point because, once again, back to those professionals, I guess I'm talking about myself. You get to a point where you're building and the sales aren't coming and it's getting tough. And then you get a recruiter in mail on LinkedIn and it's like, hey, I see you're in Web3.
Yep.
Would you like to have a conversation? And it's so tempting to just go right back to the stable, steady paycheck, which is probably more than, you've got your benefits, you've got
everything,
you
right?
just show
Stability.
Up and everything is there. And so there is probably a point in that progression, at least for me, there was where, you say, actually what I'm working on is part of me.
Yeah.
Like I really can't put it down. Yep. If I put it down, I'm losing something of myself.
Yep.
And I think that's kind of what you were, hinting at with this has to be, a mission.
Correct.
It has to be part of them.
Correct. Correct. Yeah.
Number three.
Number three. Well, I would say those who take no and just leave it at that, right? Once again, the positive side of it is we really like founders that are what we call relentlessly resourceful. Because in a startup, or pretty much in any role, right, even in my role, there's always people that would say no to you. There's always reasons why this can't be done, that can't be done. But I think what we're really looking for people, it's people who don't give excuses, but figure out ways to do it, right? Instead of saying, explaining why did I miss my targets this month that I set myself, these people say, okay, these are the three things. Can I get input on that, right? Rather than just saying, oops, sorry, guys, we didn't hit our sales targets. We didn't hit our product milestones this month. So I think really kind of the idea that someone is able to be relentless, right? Like not give up just because you get your first no, just because you face your first setback. But then you're going to combine that with resourcefulness, right? Because being relentless, just bang your head at the wall the same way doesn't bring you anywhere. So relentless combined with resourcefulness, right? Being able to discover resources everywhere, because especially in a startup, resources are constrained. I think when you put those together, that becomes a really, really powerful combination.
So have a sales mindset,
yep.
Number one. Number two, don't just be money-driven.
Correct.
Have some sort of mission in there.
Yes.
And then number three, be relentless and resourceful.
Exactly.
I think that those are really great, you know, sort of guidelines for people to think about before they even approach, hey, I want to put this together and go and talk.
Yeah.
To Chin En right now, and hopefully your inbox won't be flooded after this is released.
Yep.
So part of what you invest in, what are sort of the trends that you're looking at? What do you think is hot right now?
Yeah. So I think one of the areas that I'm really excited about, it's really the intersection of fintech and Web3, of fintech and blockchain, right? And I think it's a space that, yes, to be fair, has gotten recently hotter, but I would say that we started looking at it really seriously last year, because as we started to look around at the fintech industry, especially in Asia, right, which is kind of where our core focus is, we see that over the past decade, a lot of investments, a lot of development has happened at sort of the applications layer, right? Your insurance, your wealth tech, your payments, so on and so forth. And look, all of that is great, right? Our lives are a lot better because of those. But if you really think about how a dollar moves today, right, by and large, it's still true very archaic systems, right? If I want to send money, let's say, to India, I, for the most part, need to go through my bank, which doesn't allow me to send it on weekends, which I need to pay them fees ranging from 2% to even up to 7%, right? And this is us, right? This is us white-collar professionals, not to mention the larger kind of population out there who might be sending a lot smaller quantities, but paying the same fees that we do, right? At $10, $15, $20, which could be a sizable portion of it. So what I'm trying to say is money movement hasn't changed for the past 5 to 6 decades. But I see that's where the blockchain, distributed ledger technology, is starting to come in and radically changing how money moves, right? And my validation to that, it's if you look at almost every financial institution, they are experimenting with the blockchain in one form or the other somewhere along the journey, right? And I think it's a sign that they recognize, right? It's going to disrupt them. I don't think it's going to be in the near term. Definitely not in the next 1 or 2 years, because regulation is not there yet, right? And you can't do this without regulation, but it's going to happen to me in the next 5 to 7 years, mm-hmm. right? And so when that happens, a lot of dynamics are going to be shifted, right? A lot, I mean, banking, financial industry is a $1 trillion industry. It's power so much. But if we are saying, maybe we don't need you guys so much, right? Maybe there's an alternative out there called the blockchain, where it's trustless, it can be a lot cheaper and a lot faster, then I think that's something interesting over there, right? So I think we are at the start of what will be a major shift. So truly, kind of, I believe in Web3 in terms of like the three, right? The concept of the third wave, the third revolution, and really kind of applying that with the lens of fintech.
I feel kind of conflicted when I think about payments and Web3 because... So I was at a conference in Hong Kong yesterday, digital assets, and, you know, all of the financial services and banking players are present.
Yeah.
And, you know, our focus of our conversation is really about the regulations and how, you know, regulations can be a hurdle, but
correct.
How they actually have a lot of intelligence and experience and resources on how to craft the perfect product.
Yeah.
The innovation piece.
Yeah.
Might be what's needed. which is the reason for a lot of accelerator programs.
Correct.
And so you see that, you know, the Visas, the MasterCards, the Citis, yeah. the big banks, they're about to jump in.
Yes.
And they are jumping in.
Correct.
And then you have your little Web3 founder with their pitch deck and a dream and yep. a hope.
Yep.
And it's somehow seems to really kind of just represent the issue of, you know, we're not so decentralized.
Yep.
We are going to move back to the same old model with the same old players doing the same old things. Yep. And we'll be right back where we didn't want to be,
yep.
which is using the same institutions. And so I do feel a bit of like conflictedness about that.
That's true. But I think the way I think about it, it's so once again, I might totally be wrong on this. People might disagree. But I feel like people don't really want decentralization. What they want is censorship resistance. Right. And I think that's a big difference. Right. So decentralization, the idea of, you know, everything is a democracy, you know, there's no kind of, you know, people that are controlling the system. I personally don't think that works, right? No organization has had, like, once again, that goes back to the founder, right?
That's anarchy.
Correct. You need a founder, you need a couple of founders to come together, to commit to something, to build something, to put in the effort, to risk it all. And that's traditionally how, you know, all these companies that we are all so familiar with came about. So if you think about that, that's not decentralized, right? That's pretty centralized. But I think that that's necessary. You need people to drive it. And you need people with a vision, you need people with focus. Now, I think what people want, or one of the key benefits of decentralization is censorship resistance, right? We don't want, let's say, the government, we don't want the banks to tell us what we can or cannot do. And I think to some extent, the blockchain serves that function, right, of censorship resistance. Of course, what, is it a permission, permissionless one? Like all of that, it's still up in the air, right? And of course, these big players that are coming in, the big traditional institutions, also want a piece of the pie. But I feel like it's possible to achieve censorship resistance even with kind of with these large institutions together with the startups. Right? I think it's kind of a coexistence can happen. I just don't believe that decentralization will happen, especially in this realm of fintech and Web3 coming together. It may happen for other areas, right? Like the pure DeFi stuff, maybe. But I think the way I see it, it's at the end of the day, is there ways to make it trustless, to make it permissionless, to make it censorship resistant?
Right. Yeah. And maybe probably another one of the layers that comes to mind for me is this idea of diversity in the ownership of the thing.
Yeah.
Right. So what I would, you know, in my utopian mind, what I would like to see is more women, you know, more people of color, you
100%.
Know, having, you know, ownership of some of these tools, the SaaS. Yes. B2B resources and all of that and really building out. And it seems like that gap, as we get into this bull market, the gap is closing, the door is closing because regulations are becoming more concise.
Correct.
And if people don't get their act together and get in now, I don't think this door is going to be open in 2 years from now. I think it's going to be like, well, why would I use you, a little... Green Pod, we have, you know, we're using Visa and they already have the API for that. And it's, and by the way, their AML KYC is perfect.
yeah. You know, as you said, that just something crossed my mind about the piece about getting more women into the space, more basically the people who traditionally are minority groups, right? And I think that was honestly one of the reasons why I am so excited about Web3, right? It's because the idea that anyone can contribute to something, you don't need to ask for permission, you can go about to do it. And the culture of Web3 is such that you don't even necessarily need to dox yourself. You don't even need to reveal your identity, right? I think that solves a fundamental problem because I think plenty of research has shown, right, men always overestimate their ability. Women tend to underestimate themselves and it's like they are slightly, tend to be afraid, right, to say like, oh, can I actually deliver it? But now you kind of like, I think Web3 has created a culture where, you know, you can do it in a relatively much lower risk way, right? Where firstly, you can do it in the comfort of anywhere you are at. You don't need to be in person. Secondly, you don't even have to reveal your identity if you want, right? And I know some of the most incredible like Web3 contributors, community managers, what have you, that are women, right? Or like they're basically, one of them is even a stay-at-home mom with 3 kids who hasn't been able to find employment, but then found kind of a great kind of opportunity to moderate Discords, right, kind of in between her childcare duties. So I think really it's kind of this idea that everyone is welcome, anyone can step in and participate, that I think like the ethos, I think, is kind of what excites me for what it can potentially do too. Yeah,
absolutely. And same here. I mean, I see it as like a lot of opportunity for people.
Yeah.
So you're pretty global. Yeah. And, you know, you'll be traveling, you know, Dubai, you've got some other trips coming up.
Yep.
What do you see as like the top markets in Web3? I mean, I know you're here based in Singapore, so you're going to have to say Singapore in that top three.
Yep.
But what else are you going to add?
You know, I'm really interested in Dubai, which is why I'm really excited to go down in a month's time for Token 2049 Dubai because of VARA, right? Basically, one of the more forward regulatory authorities that have come out to say, these are the rules, these are the playground. This is the playground that we're going to set up. So I think there's going to be something interesting over there that I am personally quite excited to. And I guess the third one, which might be a bit more controversial once again, but I think it's more of a mid to long term, is basically the US, right? Look, the US probably is like the last market any Web3 founder would think about now. So many sites are geo-blocked and all. I think it's a short-term thing. Short meaning maybe 2, 3, 4 years, right? Where the current regime, the current leadership has certain views towards this. But at the end of the day, one must not forget that America remains the largest economy, right? Yeah. The hub of all capital markets. And there's also a place where democracy actually does prevail, right? To a large extent. So I think the voice of the people will be heard at some point. I think leadership will realize that they have to be changed or they'll be replaced, right? Yeah. And I think, therefore, it will continue to be a very relevant market for any founder, any Web3 founder. That's my belief.
Yeah. Wow, really interesting. I'll keep an eye on the US for you. I'll let you.
Thank
let
you. You. Thank you.
So far, it's pretty stagnant.
It's very stagnant, yeah.
But so far. No, I think that, you know, all these points and insights on, you know, what founders should be cognizant of for themselves before they approach a VC and really understanding who they are and why they're doing what they're doing is really great. And, you know, your advice to people is great, and people should really look at the different markets and the opportunities there. But get your story straight before you come.
Yeah.
Get in a call. Get it straight. Don't come and be like, I don't do sales.
Yep.
Don't come and be like, I want to hit a billion next year.
Correct.
Get it straight. Is there anything else you'd like to share with people? Any words of advice before we wrap up?
Yeah, absolutely. The one thing I always think about, and even for, especially I would say for myself as a VC, where I would say it's one of the most commoditized business, because what we offer is just capital and a dollar is a dollar, right? It's really sort of the what's your right to win, right? As a founder. Or as a leader of a company, right? And that's also kind of intentionally, for example, why for Saison Capital, I'm planting the flag of Web3, FinTech and Web3 as the space sort of that we want to win in. Because at the end of the day, we recognize our roots, right? We are not A16Z crypto, we're not Paradigm, we're not Dragonfly. And so at the end of the day, if I want to come out and say, I want to be the next best, Web3 infrastructure investor, sure, maybe I could get there, but it's going to be a challenge, right? Because I'm fighting with these guys who are crypto native, who have been there much longer, and all of that. But here I am who figured, okay, given my resources, given my heritage, given my background, I think there is actually a real kind of opportunity to plant our flag, right? And sort of be the leader, be one of the most active investors in the emerging use cases of fintech and blockchain, which is kind of why I was sharing earlier. And I think the same advice goes to founders or pretty much anyone out there, right? For you, what is your unfair right to win in the market? Because whatever you think of, there's probably 10, 20, 100 people that are doing the same thing, right? They're all running at the same pace as you, even faster. Some might be more well-capitalized, so on and so forth. So at the end of the day, to me, it's like, if you want to win, then you need to first define what your playground looks like, right? And be clear that this is my unfair advantage, right? My unfair advantage is that I have the backing of a large Japanese traditional finance institution. So, you know, it could be seen as a liability, but I'm trying to take it into and make it into an advantage, right? And so I think the same goes for founders out there, right? What is your true unfair advantage when you launch the next protocol? Yeah.
I think know thyself is really the message in this for founders, even for VCs, like you said, you have to know your niche, know the target founders that you're looking to work with.
Correct.
And I think that's a great message to send.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being on, Shinen.
Thank you so much, Jamelia.